I'm Karen Lewis, and welcome to Recovery Bites, a show that gets real about recovery, where we welcome voices in the field and voices of experience. Join me for candid interviews with experts in eating disorder and mental health recovery. Listeners can look forward to new perspectives, meaningful conversation, diverse connection, and compelling personal narratives that make a powerful difference in how we live. Episodes focus on life beyond recovery, the good and the not so good, the successes and the challenges, and the authentic accounts of recovered lives. Not their whole story, just bites. If you are an experienced, well-trained therapist with lived experience whose clinical approach aligns with the values represented in these podcast episodes, or if you are seeking treatment, we would love to hear from you. Please go to our website, KarenLewisEDC.com/apply. All right, everyone, here we go. This is a very special episode. It is special for two reasons. One, I am announcing that we are taking a hiatus. Did I say that correctly? Hiatus. So we're taking some time off from the show, but more importantly is our guests. We have Angela Goins and Whitney Trotter, who are guests today. And let me tell you, they are powerful, incredible souls. And wait till you hear what they have to say. All right, let's just jump right in. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Recovery Bites. I am really excited to introduce both of our guests today. We have Angela Goins and Whitney Trotter. First, I'd like to welcome you both to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I'm so honored to have the two of you on the show. Everything we're going to be talking about is so important to be brought to the surface. And the two of you are doing an incredible job of just trying to teach people these important lessons. So I'm just going to ask either of you, if you'd like to start, who would like to start, say who you are and a little bit about yourself.
You go first, Angela.
Hello, everyone. My name is Angela. I am a registered dietitian in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I have a private practice where I see individual clients, provide supervision and consulting. I also do some work with EDRD Pro. You might see my face there with the educational webinars and development. And then a third part of my major role is the director of nutrition at a group collective here in the city. So, of course, the big adventure right now that both Whitney and I are working on is the conference. And we'll certainly talk a lot about that. But coming up in July, the BIPOC conference.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Whitney, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Whitney Trotter. I'm a dietitian and nurse in Memphis, Tennessee. Hopefully we'll be a psych MP very soon. Angela has been on the journey with me the last few years. So I'm excited to hopefully wrap up that chapter. But similar to Angela, I have a private practice where I do one-on-one nutritional counseling work. And I also provide supervision, consultation, and do a lot of public speaking about the intersection of eating disorders, particularly in underrepresented communities. And then I also do a lot of anti-trafficking work, not as much as I used to, but doing a lot of training and education for medical professionals.
I think where I'd like to begin is I'd sort of like to, I'm going to use the word enlighten some of the listeners with some of the challenges that are faced when you're talking about the intersection of eating disorder and underrepresented people. And then as a result, I'd like to hear more about the BIPOC conference so then people can have it better in context. And so You know, it's so interesting because I always do a lot of work before these interviews, and I do my research and all this stuff. And I had this image or this idea where I think, Whitney, it was you, had said that there was a time when you were one of the only Black dietitians in your group, or when you were working at a program, at a residential program, and forgive me if I'm saying this inappropriately. And I know this might be a strange place to start, but what does that feel like as somebody who is, and I'm not assuming, you know, you're there as an authority figure, you're grounded, you're comfortable in what you're doing. And the reason why I'm asking that is because then I want to flip it of what would it be like to be the one person in treatment when you're not an authority figure, you don't have the privilege to be a client in an underrepresented population. Am I making sense?
Yeah, for me, and Angela can speak to this too, I don't know that you as the Black clinician are ever grounded working eating disorders. I mean, you know, like just to be frank, particularly because I was the only clinician. We had a lot of amazing support staff, and you see that in treatment centers. There's very few clinicians of color, and specifically Black clinicians, that work at higher level of care. And Angela and I both have worked at higher level of care. And so it's a very isolating experience. And I think some of that speaks to clients of color and Black clients in particular kind of gravitating towards clinicians, because when you're in a place, it doesn't matter what type of mental health treatment, right? When you're in any type of facility and you only see one other person that shares an identity than you, you can't be grounded. It's just impossible to be grounded in those experiences. And so it's hard again. And, you know, I've shared this a lot. I think prior to 2020, nobody was having these conversations. I won't say no one cared. I do think there were individuals and clinicians who did care about diversity, but it definitely wasn't talked about. It wasn't prioritized. I mean, it's almost as like the ED center, like had a light bulb moment in 2020. It was like, oh, there are BIPOC clinicians who work in this space, and oh, there are BIPOC people that have eating disorders. We should do something about it, you know? And it's like, I mean, I've been a dietitian over 10 years, and, you know, and Angela can talk about her journey, but we're not new clinicians. And I think a lot of 2020 people were like, oh my gosh, like we were popping on the scene. We were new to social media, but we weren't new clinicians, you know? And so, I think that's one of the most interesting things, but it can be very isolating. It can be very siloed, and it can be extremely hard trying to bridge the gap of being a clinician in a space where no one looks like you.
Mm-hmm. Angela, did you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I would have to agree. My early years are rooted in working at higher level of care and mental health treatment centers, then I have nothing but agreement with Whitney. It's definitely isolating. I think the entire time, and I've worked at a number of large treatment centers, specifically treating eating disorders. And I'm not sure I've ever worked with any other Black, I have never worked with another Black dietitian. I mean, part of this pandemic has been so exciting in that I've been able to connect with a lot of dietitians who are just like me doing this work, but certainly not in my day-to-day work. And to flip to your question of what it's like for a client, I can't even begin to imagine, because like you said, we have more of our roles are much different. And to get into a place where you can't relate to anyone, there's definitely this bonding that happens or connection that happens with clients. From underrepresented identities with any provider, even if it's support staff at times. But it's definitely isolating and challenging, even just to get your voice heard, have ideas understood and played out in the higher level of development of programming and creation of things. It's very challenging.
And I'm imagining can create additional trauma for a client. if they are not feeling understood, if their culture is not feeling represented or seen, or if they are, you know, it's, we live in such a white-centric, Eurocentric time where, you know, it is, forgive me for like getting stuck on my words. I'm very passionate about this. It's, I mean, how does a client go into treatment? Let me take a step back. What do treatment centers need to do? I don't work in treatment centers anymore, but I did for many, many years. So this conversation is not new for me, and this idea is not new for me. So what are treatment centers lacking? What do they need to do so everybody feels included, seen, heard, represented? I'll stop there.
You know, I always wonder, like, why was it not a priority before? Like, again, we did not start diagnosing Black people with eating disorders in 2020. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand why prior to, like, that's like my biggest question. Why is it all of a sudden a priority now? Is there some like checkbox that you're trying to check? And I think if you don't have access to clinicians on staff that hold similar identities to clients, then you can do contract. You can find a clinician. You know, that's what Angela and I, one of the things we were so passionate about creating the BIPOC ED conference is not only to educate non-BIPOC clinicians, but also to provide education for BIPOC clinicians who work in this space and who want to work in this space. And so there's no reason now in 2023 with all the virtual accessible options we have that treatment centers can't contract out with people.
Angela, do you have anything to add to that? Or
I mean, just to answer your question, there's a lot of things that treatment centers can do differently. There's a long list. And I'm not sure that they're really willing to do that. I think on the surface, that's the question, but I'm not sure that people are really willing to hear what would best serve or better serve a much more diverse set of clients. That's not my job to figure out, but I think Whitney and I get asked that question quite a bit. Like, well, what can we do differently? What should we be doing? And I mean, we can certainly help guide that, but there's a lot of internal questions that need to be asked and answered before even bringing in consultation. I mean, is that really what people want to do? And what would that look like?
I think that's the deeper issue. And that's it right there. Is this what people really want to do? Is it something that they're doing because of checking a box? I think going into your own internal biases is really important. And so that's the bigger question than giving a guide sheet to here's how you do it. Talk about how the BIPOC conference was born. I mean, besides the fact that there has been this incredible need, and also, was there any resistance that you got?
You want to go first, Angela?
I was going to tell you to go first. I think it started with a wonderful friendship, but it's Whitney's seed that she planted. So I want you to share what that was like for you in reaching out. So please.
Yeah, Angela and I feel like it's been so long since we've been friends, but I know that it realistically hasn't. Like Angela said, pandemic really brought a lot of us together. I think I had newly joined Instagram, like, I want to say a couple months before the pandemic hit, you know? And I was really looking for a space to where I could just collaborate with other BIPOC RDs, other Black RDs working in the space, and connected with Jessica Wilson, connected with Angela, and we kind of started a Black EDRD peer group that meets once a month. And then I just had a pretty traumatic experience 2021, and I was on medical leave for several months, and then I had to restart my semester, and I just needed, honestly, a distraction. And I was just really sick and tired of kind of how the traditional landscape of eating disorders was going. Like you said earlier, just very Eurocentric, very whitewashed. I think we were all getting a lot of attention because, again, people for some reason like just thought that we were new to the field of eating disorders. I mean, and we're over a decade into our profession, you know? And so I really wanted to do something different and make an impact. And so I called Angela. I was like, Angela, I cannot do this without you. I really, really need you to help. And so where I have a lot of strengths and a lot of weaknesses, Angela, like, just, I mean, is so good at every weakness that I have. It works well because those are her strengths. And so this, it was a seed that was birthed in like my heart and soul, but definitely Angela, like, as cliche as it sounds, like, watered the seed and it flourished because she knows me pretty well and it would not have happened without her. So yeah, I called her and I was like, I think we could do this. And originally she thought I was a little crazy because I think it was like February and I wanted to do it in May for Mental Health Awareness Month. But then we decided to push it back till July for BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month. And now we're going on year two, which is like even wilder. I never thought we would. It was like such a dream. It was wild what we put off, the two of us being parents of young kids, both being business owners, working full time. I just am still shocked to this day that we were able to pull a conference of that magnitude off, to be quite honest.
I don't think people truly understand how much goes into creating a conference. Like, Angela, we were talking for a few minutes before recording and even just like applying to be a CEU or whatever. I know everyone, I call them CEU. Some people call them CEs. Like it's not just like you sign a box and say, I want to do a conference. I mean, there is so much that goes into it.
Absolutely. There is, plenty of things we learned along the way as well. It's not as simple as one would think. And the way we were creating it to really have this ripple effect into more than just the dietetics world, we wanted to include, and we were sure to include, you know, therapists, which is kind of a broad term, right? There's lots of different boards. There are lots of different degrees and credentials and doctors and nurses and advocates and family members. So that required a lot of work. We had some wonderful assistance from the Eating Disorder Alliance and some interns and some other colleagues along the way. But for the most part, like two people having an idea and creating it in a matter of months and putting out there was largely successful to more of this grassroots effort of people really championing and wanting to support and provide and attend and be part of something as it was starting and growing from our small niche in this world. So there was some resistance, yeah, absolutely. But I think we still triumphed and we still provided something amazing for the community, which is why we're going at it a second year. But there's a lot that goes into it. We tried to start a little earlier this, give ourselves a little bit more time here, have some deadlines. We can, you know, move those around if we need to. They don't need to be so final because we're literally going to run out of time. But yeah, we definitely tried to grow it and make some changes and respond to some of the feedback we got last year. We even added an additional day. So it's now 4 days instead of three. So there's some changes on the way and some announcements coming up, which we're very excited about as well.
Say a little bit about the conference, because I want people who are listening, there's a lot of professionals that listen to this podcast. I want them to know what goes on at the BIPOC conference. What are the topics? What are the things? I mean, here I am saying earlier, like, you know, what do treatment centers need to know? And granted, this is not, again, an instruction book in how to be in the world, but there's going to be a lot of great information.
I would love for every treatment center to pay to register, quite frankly, and professionals. Like, I think we, Angela is particularly with her work for EDRD Pro, just is so amazing at capturing what is, what we don't have education wise. And that was one of our biggest things, is we didn't just want it to be another conference where it was like the same recycling and redundant information. Like, we, every single person is a person of color, and that obviously BIPOC conference was important to us, but the topics, and I'll let Angela like share more about the topics were so important to us because we wanted it to be new information. And, you know, I say this a lot too, we're so much more, I don't mind doing identity speaking work, you know, talking about BIPOC and eating disorders, but there's so many of us that work in eating disorders that have so much to offer outside of just our shared lived experiences and identities. And that was also important to us too, of just the different niches and the kind of different modalities in which we work within the eating disorder field.
We have some amazing presenters and topics coming up for this year, and I will share some of those. And I wish I had the list in front of me, so I'm not intentionally forgetting anyone, but we've got some great speakers presenting on medical apartheid. There's going to be some topics around two-spirit and non-gender or non-binary client work. There's going to be some information presented on ketamine treatment, psychedelics, harm reduction care. My gosh, there's so many. Whitney, any like titles or topics coming to mind for you?
Oh my gosh, I'm really excited about the ketamine, particularly because I just got trained in the intranasal Spravato. So I'm really excited about that. We're doing only two panels this year. One, we're going to do movement and how movement can be incorporated within ED treatment. And so that was really important to us. We're doing a barriers to treatment. So really talking and digging deep about what are the current barriers to treatment access. We've got a bariatric surgery, food insecurity, malnutrition, and post-bariatric surgery clients that I'm really excited about. As well, oh gosh, Angela, what?
Eating disorders and dance.
Yes, yes.
Diabetes in Black communities, food insecurity.
I know, I'm trying to think because I don't have the schedule. In front of me.
You know what we'll do? We'll definitely post the link. We're about to announce all of the topics and presenters. And while there are so many amazing presenters, we opened it up this year for proposals. We had close to 100 proposals come through. That's part of why we extended the day. We also wanted to offer the continuing education for people, but there were a lot of amazing presenters and topics to choose from. So, and like Whitney said earlier, we just wanted to bring some speakers that maybe you don't typically hear from that are doing amazing work in their little world, and bring some exposure to them. But also the topics and research and work they're doing with the populations they work with. And these are therapists, dietitians, nurses, advocates across the board. Psychiatrists, yeah, we've got a great spread.
Oh, you know what, Angela, I wanted to share this too. We've got, which I didn't know, I actually did a congressional panel with Dr. Reyes, and she agreed to speak. And she, to my knowledge, created the first ever culturally competent ED screening and studied it. She's Spanish speaking, studied it in Puerto Rico. And so she's going to be presenting on current research and clinical applications in the Latina community. So I'm pretty excited about that one too.
When you talk about barriers to treatment, that has got to be an enormous one, which is the eating disorder screening tools are made for the white cisgender female. BMI was created for men. I mean, there are so many things that again create barriers to treatment, and I'm that's amazing that tool has been created. I don't know why I'm sort of stuck on this, but because I'm very interested by it, can you share a little bit about ketamine? I have clients that are doing ketamine treatments, and you know, there's some people that it feels controversial. Some people think it's amazing. Like, can you tell me what your experience is and why you're excited about this talk on ketamine?
Oh yeah. So Allison and I connected last year. She was one of the first therapists that I knew of that was doing psychedelics and was doing like the ketamine assisted therapy. I live in the South, so we're just behind on a lot of things. But ketamine is not covered by insurance for depression, PTSD, but intranasal ketamine, Spravato, is what, in which the clinic that I did all of my hours in, they were a REM center, like a center that met all the guidelines and X, Y, and Z. And we did a lot of Spravato and we saw a lot of eating disorder clients. And Spravato is indicated treatment-resistant depression and acute suicidal ideation. And so I love it when we're talking about eating disorders because we can keep people at a higher level of care. It is controversy because you have to have a driver. So you have to have somebody that you cannot drive 2 hours post intranasal Spravato ketamine. And so that is a barrier. Some insurances will cover it completely. Some insurances will not. And you typically start off about 2 to 3 times a week. And so transportation can be a huge barrier for some people. But I have seen just in this year alone, people get off a lot of oral medications. I've seen people be able to really treat their depression and acute suicidal ideation to where, again, they didn't have to go into higher level of care and be re-traumatized, and they were able to stay outpatient. They were able to work. And that's really important when we talk about barriers to treatment care. You know, not every state has an residential eating disorder center, right? And so that's one of the biggest things is people can't just leave their job 6 to 8 weeks and go to residential and then PHP, IOP out of state. That's a huge barrier, particularly if you're a single parent or maybe the breadwinner in your family. And so I'm just so excited about the future of psychedelics and what this means, not only for mental health, like broadly, but specifically eating disorder care.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredible treatment. I've had Adele LaFrance on the show, and she talked about psychedelics and eating disorders. And I mean, it's powerful. It is powerful how effective it can be. Let's talk about some other barriers to treatment for the BIPOC community. So what are some others besides there's a list, there's financial, there's misdiagnosis, there's, you know, like you said, distance, things like that. What are other barriers to treatment?
What always comes to mind for me is like backing it up all the way to the very beginning and thinking about the diagnosis piece of this, where it's missed often for those with marginalized identities or misdiagnosed, right? Or attributed to weight instead or other factors. And I mean, how do you get into treatment or even get to the right people if that's not even on your radar? So I think it goes back so much farther, but certainly when you get into the stages of treatment, or let's say you have a diagnosis or even someone's trying to rule it out, which I think is a wonderful step as well. At least you're getting to say, meet with a psychiatrist, a psychologist, potentially a dietitian, to really maybe rule something out or learn more about your pattern behaviors and what's been going on for X amount of time, and to really get to talk to somebody about it instead of just a quick conversation or a quick check of vitals and weight and height and assumptions made. So that diagnosing piece I think is really key. And then as people progress to potentially moving into levels of care, certainly Whitney talked about when you get into residential, if you are a single parent or a breadwinner, to leave your home, your work, your environment, I mean, you may not have a job if you were to do that. Who's going to care for your animals? Who's going to care for your home? Who's going to pay your bills? Who's going to watch your children? There's lots of pieces that insurance wouldn't cover, even if they would cover the care, right? What's going on in their world and having to exit from that is quite challenging. And there's very little support for that or even conversations around that. You know, if that's a recommendation to go to a higher level of inpatient or residential for an unknown amount of time or an approximate amount of time, what about all of those responsibilities you would need to leave behind? And is that even possible for someone to do? And oftentimes people say, I can't do it. I understand that may be important for me. It'd be very helpful for me potentially, but I can't do that. And so is that seen as a refusal? And then what happens? Are they never allowed that level of care again? Are they given other options? Sometimes people are very firm in their recommendation and may choose not to work with somebody if they don't follow, you know, those recommendations of going to higher level of care. So we have to have other options for people who have different life circumstances, weren't able to maybe at that time to do the level of care you may be recommending. And even if they were to get there, right, there's different stages to this. And now what would it be like for somebody to be in a place that is not always safe, feels very different from their home and community environment? And how are they supposed to settle in, work on themselves, and then transition back into life when there's a full sense of security and safety potentially for them? So again, getting into what could change at a treatment center is a probably much longer podcast, but I think if you kind of look at it in those three stages or steps, in the very beginning is, I think, where the problem starts, and that initial recognizing that there is more going on here than just, what's on paper or the actual numbers that you're seeing in the reports or the weight or the height, and to get people the care that they deserve from the beginning.
Yeah. So can we then talk about a harm reduction model? Because there's controversy in that. And then there's other, there's also that could actually be what saves people's lives. And so when there's barriers to treatment and things like that. So, I think you said you're having a talk on harm reduction. So how does harm reduction model come into this then when there are barriers?
Yeah, we're going to have Gloria Lucas speak to this. She's wonderful. She's been doing this for quite a while, but you'll be able to hear more from her on this. But a harm reduction model is absolutely an option. If you have team members who are open to working with clients sort of meeting them where they're at and what they're able to and committed to doing at that time.
I think it's important to note too that harm reduction really came out of like a BIPOC-centered perspective and a need of survival. And Gloria Lucas, like Angela said, I mean, she's been doing this for so long, and I really value her just expertise and lived experience. And Angela and I do a lot of supervision and consultation, and it is hard being a licensed clinician. Liability is always in the back of our mind, and it's hard to. When we talk about healthcare as political, it is hard because you see a lot of legislation wanting to criminalize healthcare workers. And I understand, eating disorders is the second deadliest mental illness, right? And so we talk a lot about too, like, what is liability intertwined with the harm reduction model? But I remember when I first started doing supervision, there were so many providers that would fire clients if they did not go to higher level of care and did not understand the barriers and why somebody could not go to higher level of care. And so I really love that Gloria and some of the other people out there are really speaking to this harm reduction model, because for so long our community was not, it was not even a conversation. They would literally, I cannot tell you how many clinicians that I know that would just fire clients. Say, if you can't go, I'm sorry, I can't work with you. And again, each case should be taken with an individual approach. And there are definitely times where somebody medical safety needs to go to higher level of care. Absolutely. But I just love that this conversation is changing now within our community dynamics of eating disorder care and accessible care.
Gloria was on the podcast. She's phenomenal. So we had this whole conversation about harm reduction, and it is unfortunate and a little terrifying when you think about the fact that mental health services do also have a political component and things such as liability and whatnot. And so how do you balance that out when you have a client? You know what I mean? Where do you start?
Yeah, supervision. Yeah. Our supervision exists, and your supervision should be intersectional. Like, you need to be having supervision and consultation from diverse people, and not just the same person. Like, even people that I see in supervision, I'm always giving them a list of names too, of like, you need to reach out to this person, meet with this person. Because everybody has different experiences and lived experiences and knowledge.
Yeah, I would add that you don't go about doing that work alone. So absolutely supervision, but this is a team approach, and deciding to do some harm reduction work with clients and meet them where they're at and just see where that progresses. Like, this isn't something you as a provider want to or should be doing alone, right? Like there should be additional support. And, that team approach is going to be very key in this process. So, you don't want to be the sole provider doing that work and holding or bearing that entire responsibility, that you want to be doing that with others.
Mm-hmm. And it's true. And it does, working with teams is incredibly important. And I also can't speak highly enough to supervision. I love collaborating with my colleagues and not feeling like I am alone in a decision. Even if I'm working with a team of doctors and dietitians and psychiatrists, there are some things that as the therapist myself or you guys as the dietitian do feel like you're holding alone. And so I wholeheartedly believe in supervision and that support. I guess where I would like to go, let me ask you a question, either of you. Is there something that I haven't asked? I mean, I could sit here and talk and be like, let me ask you this and let me ask you that. But I have these two incredible souls that are sitting across from me. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to ask this. What do you guys want to say?
No, I have a thought. I have a thought because it comes up a lot for us in regards to the conference. Regarding the conference being a BIPOC eating disorder conference, a lot of clinicians or people want to know, well, I'm not BIPOC, can I attend? Or I don't identify as having, one of these marginalized identities. Who is this for? They're not sure if they can ask or what this means or what is this about? Should I just sponsor? Can I attend? There's all sorts of questions. And I think it's important to just say that, the sort of basis of the conference and what we want to be doing is educating providers who don't fall into these groups, or whether you feel like you serve these clients or not, there's plenty to learn, and why aren't you serving a diverse set of clients? Maybe that's the question. So coming to the conference, learning from amazing presenters, researchers, therapists, dietitians, et cetera, about the work they're doing and the ways you can be incorporating and better serving or treating, finding and diagnosing, whatever sort of aspects of care you provide, that this conference is for you. So I just want to put that out there, that there's a lot of amazing people to learn from and a lot of things that you could be bringing home and incorporating into the work that you're doing to either grow the client base that you have or to better serve those who you do work with. So that question or some form of that question often comes up, like not people not being sure if it's a conference for them. It is for everyone. Absolutely. We want to put that out there. And, we're offering early bird tickets and it's virtual. So we want to make it as accessible as possible. We will have ASL interpreters again this year for some of the presentations. And again, we just wanted to bring forth a wide variety of presenters from different backgrounds and on amazing topics. So this is for everyone.
That was one of the most asked questions. So I'm so glad, Angela, that you brought that up because this conference is for anyone and everyone. And we're just so thrilled to have it again this year. And you said something earlier, Angela, that I just wanted to highlight too, like the grassroots effort that it took, like our community really came and rallied last year and this year as well, because we can't run a conference without supervision, not supervision, I'm sorry. We can't run a conference without sponsorship and without donation. And I'm going to brag on us, like there's a lot of ED conferences that don't pay speakers. And we really prided ourselves in not only paying, but paying very well last year. And so that is really important to us, is that we are able to host a conference of excellence with BIPOC thought leaders and creators, but to pay people. And in order to do that, we need people to register and support the conference. So
it's wonderful having both of you on. Before we close, is there anything else that I didn't ask that you would like to share with listeners, either of you?
I would just say I'm excited to get to continue to connect with people I'm not currently taking any more one-on-one like nutritional clients, but I am taking more supervision and consultation. And so excited to connect with colleagues and again, just work with Angela and Nir too for this conference.
Angela, anything else?
Yeah, I agree with Whitney. I'm available for consultation as well, but I just encourage all providers to really put in the work this year to be creating space to serve all clients, not just those they feel comfortable with, but to really offer care and the accessibility of care across the states for clients who are struggling, whether it's an actual or diagnosed eating disorder or disordered pattern behaviors around food. You have the expertise to share your knowledge, and you may not be the right fit, but to know how to refer on or to share with others. And again, that team approach and working with clients who deserve care. I want to put that out there as well.
Again, I want to thank you both. And I do have to sort of let everyone know that Whitney was doing this without a cup of coffee.
Yes. people that know me will be shocked.
I didn't say anything earlier, but I was like, wait a minute. So I want to give an extra thanks for anybody who would do this without a cup of morning coffee. So I just want to say thank you, Whitney. And Angela, of course, thank you, but without coffee, that's a big thing, right?
Angela knows me too. It is rare that I could make it this long, but I will be going to get a cup in creamer today. So yeah.
I hope you enjoy. All right, everyone. That does it for another episode of Recovery Bites. I look forward to speaking with each and every one of you next week. Take care and stay safe. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Recovery Bites. Be sure to visit recoverybitespodcast.com to join the conversation, access show notes, listen to past episodes, and more. You can also find us by searching for Recovery Bites on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major podcast streaming players. For weekly episode releases, you can follow us at Recovery Bites Pod on Instagram. If you're interested in becoming a guest on the show or to submit a guest request, please visit KarenLewisEDC.com/podcast signup to begin the process. I'd also like to send out a heartfelt thank you to my producer, Jen Galvin. It is unbelievable the magic she does behind the scenes. All right, everyone. See you next week for another Recovery Bite. Thanks for listening.